Accession number 20119, Reel 1.
Colonel Gibbon, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in London on the 7th of July 1921, actually in the Tower of London.
You were telling me earlier that you're connected with Gibbon the historian.
Yes, I was. I believe we belonged to the same family, but of course not a direct descendant, because he was a bachelor.
And can you tell me about your immediate family background and how you came to be born in the Tower, please?
My father was a regular soldier in the Royal Army Medical Corps, and at the time of my birth he was MO to the battalion of, I think, of Grenadiers, who were then stationed in the Tower of London.
Did you grow up in London?
No, we didn't. Being an army family, we were posted all around the place. My father commanded the military hospital in Colchester, and he was also in India and Burma. I was sent home when I was 6 to prep school in Southsea near Portsmouth. We never really got a home until the end of the Second World War, a permanent home that is, until the end of the Second World War, when he bought a house called Errington in County Tyrone between Omagh and Enniskillen, where my younger brother now lives.
Where else did you have your schooling?
I was at school, prep school, in Aldborough on the east coast, and then went from there to Wellington College in 1935, and left there in 1939. Had 6 months at home before I went into the army properly on the 19th of July 1940 as a private soldier in the Royal Berkshire Regiment.
Had you always wanted an army career?
Yes, all my family were in the services. My first cousins, who were double first cousins, because my mother and their mother were sisters, and my father and their father were brothers. Three of them were in the Royal Tank Regiment, and one was in the Royal Navy. So yes, I mean, I was always set on an army career.
Did you go from Wellington to Sandhurst?
I did, in fact, via Brock Barracks in Reading, but it was not the Royal Military College then. It was an OCTU, an Officer Cadet Training Unit. But as it happens, I went there, yes.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Indeed, yes. That was at home at in Glen Cree, name of the house, just outside Omagh in County Tyrone, where my father had a half-pay job looking after the medical inspection room of the depot of the Royal Enniskillen Fusiliers. He was then called up at the beginning of war and became ADMS Northern Ireland.
How did you feel about the news?
It's an awful long time ago. I think possibly rather excited more than anything else.
What happened to you immediately after the outbreak of war?
I went back to Wellington for one term, and then, as I say, I had 6 months during that term, we were all enlisted in the army, other people of my age, but we weren't called up until we were 19, and I went into the army, to the Royal Berkshire Regiment, 10 days or so after my 19th birthday in 1940.
Did you experience any bombing of England about this time?
No, funnily enough, Reading wasn't attacked at all, as that I remember. I mean, one saw the sort of anti-aircraft fire and the bombs landing on London, not so very far away. But no, I had no experience of actual enemy action at all.
What kind of experience did you have in Reading with the Berkshires?
It was a basic training unit. It was an IT or infantry training centre. And after we were put together, mostly people from Wellington, in a potential officer squad for 3 months, I think. And then we were made acting unpaid lance corporals and sent out to in charge of a hut full of militiamen, I think they were called. And in my case, they were 30-year-olds from Hackney in East London. And they were marvellous. They taught me an awful lot. I mean, I was a very naive ex-public schoolboy in those days. I don't know, they teased me unmercifully, which was very good for me. I didn't understand a word what they said with our company, and doubtless they didn't understand what I was talking about. But nevertheless, teasing me in private was one thing, but in public they were marvellously supportive. Any wrong orders on the parade ground that I happened to give them in drill, they ignored and did what they were supposed to do. They were super.
What in particular did they teach you?
I think a deal of self-reliance. One, as a public schoolboy, I think in those days you led a very sheltered life, and one of these people from East London had an esprit de corps and a sense of belonging and loyalty to each other that one hadn't experienced before.
And can you tell me what happened next, please?
In about November, I suppose, I was told I was going to Octo at Sandhurst, and about five of us from the depot of the Royal Berkshire Regiment joined Sandhurst, and we were posted to C Company, which was, in fact, everybody else but us were members of the Household Brigade, the five regiments of foot guards. Quite by how we arrived there, I have no idea, but we were. And we had rather a famous company sergeant major, Company Sergeant Major Lord, who was a very fierce warrant officer. He achieved some notoriety later on in the war when he, I think, was parachute regiment, regimental sergeant major. And he turned out, when they were relieved by the Americans, he turned out a quarter guard of soldiers armed with pick helves and their brasses cleaned and their gaiters and belts blankoed, which was an incredible achievement. He was a great man.
How did he treat the people under him?
He was a very strict disciplinarian indeed. I think we were all the youngest amongst us, like myself. There were a number of people who were rather older, in their 30s. They seemed very aged to me. Were probably not quite so frightened of him, but I think most true to say that most of us were fairly scared of him. But he was very fair. I do remember that.
Any incidents that happened to you at Sandhurst?
I don't think so. One of the Germans did, in fact, bomb one of the wings and killed, I think, two or three cadets, one of whom was one of my great friends, which was sad.
What do you remember about that bombing?
Nothing at all, really, I'm afraid.
Were you there?
I was there, I think. Yes, I'm sure I was. But it's just an incident that I remember because of this friend of mine who was killed. But I don't remember anything more about it.
So it wasn't your wing?
It was in my. He was in my company, yes. But where we were at the time, I have no idea. I suspect out in the shelters. I'd known Sandhurst pretty well, of course, because my father had been, before the war, when I was just before I went to Wellington, was MO of the Royal Military Academy, Royal Military College. And so I knew the ground and the land intimately, which made map reading a bit of a farce, because I knew it rather better than anybody else did. As a small boy, one used to walk and take the dogs and play, in inverted commas, around the place.
And was the course concertinaed because of the war?
Oh, yes. I mean, pre-war, I think you did. I really don't know because I never did it, but I think it was about a two-year training. We did it in 6 months. I was commissioned in March 1941.
What happened then?
When I was commissioned?
Yes.
I was commissioned into the family regiment, the Royal Irish Fusiliers, and was posted to Ballykinlow in Northern Ireland.
What happened there?
This Ballykinla was an infantry training centre for the Irish Fusiliers, and I had a training platoon. I was then weapon training officer, and then after a bit it closed, and where the whole unit went to Omagh in County Tyrone, where it trained soldiers for the whole of the North Irish Brigade.
What kind of weapons were you dealing with?
Oh, ordinary infantry weapons, you know, the light machine gun, the Bren, rifle, the Piat anti-tank weapon, and so on. In Omagh, I was carrier platoon commander and trained drivers to drive the carriers, the Bren gun carriers, so-called.
What kind of men, what was the background of the men you had under you in the RIF?
They were conscripted soldiers in the main, but there were quite a high percentage of volunteers from Southern Ireland who came up and joined because, I should think mainly because their forebears had joined the army. But I don't recall ever inquiring into the precise reasons as to why. But certainly a lot of them did live in the south. A lot of them came from Birmingham or Manchester, indeed. You know, it was quite a mix-up.
Did the Southern Irish soldiers perform any differently from the others?
Absolutely not.
Any specific incidents from those days in Northern Ireland?
I don't really remember any, no. It was, of course, an armed... There were soldiers everywhere. The Americans then came over, of course, and that was their first place where they were stationed. And they were a novelty, certainly, though I don't recall ever being in touch, ever meeting them at all.
What impact did the arrival of American soldiers have on life in Northern Ireland?
I'm sure it must have had an enormous amount, but from my very narrow perspective, as a very junior officer, one, it didn't impinge on me at all.
And you were with an actual battalion at this time?
No, this was the training centre, and I was then posted to the 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Fusiliers, who were then in Thetford in Norfolk.
Can you tell me about that, please?
I was posted, then they formed an anti-tank platoon, and I was selected by the commanding officer to command it. And we had 6 2-pounder anti-tank guns, which had been offloaded by the Royal Artillery anti-tank regiments when they were re-equipped with 6-pounders. The 2-pounders were a remarkably ineffective little gun, and luckily I never had to actually go into action and fire them in anger against tanks. We then went up to Scotland and was stationed in Ayrshire, I should say. Round about the villages round the town of Ayr, Girvan and Maybole, and the sort of company location in each. And while we were there, the big exercise was Exercise Wetshod, I think, which was, although we didn't know it at the time, was the preparation for the landings in North Africa, Operation Torch, which we took part in eventually in the autumn of 1942, I suppose.
What do you personally remember about Operation Wetshod?
Rather silly ones. I mean, I was, as an anti-tank platoon commander, I had to ride a motorbike throughout the thing, which was a petrifying thing, because we were a lorry-borne infantry. We were the lorry infantry brigade of 7th, of the 6th Armoured Division. And there were God knows how many motorcycles. And riding a motorbike at night in company with 30 or 40 other motorbikes was exciting, to say the least. And I remember doing that once, with rather cunningly dropping back 2 cars and not riding behind the commanding officer's car, which I was ordered to do. But I dropped back a car or so and rode with one or two or three others.
Why did you do that?
I thought it was jolly dangerous riding without lights with 30 or 40 other motorbikes behind one car. It was too. I think there were quite a number of crashes. But other than that, Wetshod was a long exercise which took all place all over southwestern Scotland, Ayrshire and Dumfriesshire and that sort of area.
Was the 1st Battalion part of a division at that time?
It was part of 38th Irish Brigade, the 1st Battalion of the Irish Fusiliers, the 1st Enniskilling Fusiliers, and the London Irish Rifles made up the three battalions. And we went out to North Africa, as I say, in about November 1942 on a troop ship.
Can you tell me about the voyage, please?
The troop ship was called the Tegelberg. It belonged to the a Dutch line. It was a Dutch ship, and it was staffed by Dutch officers with a native, I suppose now they'd be called Indonesian, crew. And we sailed from the Clyde. No, we didn't. I was wrong. We sailed from Liverpool. And I think the voyage was without incident, except when we got as far as Gibraltar, and off Gibraltar, our troop ship was hit by another ship in the convoy. I suppose they zigged and we zagged or something, whoever was to blame, we didn't know, but we were all out on deck wearing life jackets at abandoned ships. It was daylight, so there was no particular danger. But the only of note was that all the crew leapt overboard with wild cries, and you could see them drifting off. When I say it was daylight, it was just about dusk. You could see they had little red lights on their life jackets, which lit up automatically as they hit the water, and you could see them floating out towards the Atlantic, actually, because that was the way the current was setting. And they lowered a motorboat, and screams of everybody shouting in English and Dutch and Indonesian. And they roared off into the night, but unfortunately they'd forgotten to undo the line. And so they came roaring back again almost as fast and clanged into the side of the ship, which made the soldiers laugh till they were nearly cried, they were laughing so much. And then we had to go into Gibraltar for a couple of days for repair. And we were all allowed off the ship, half a battalion at a time, which was fine.
Was much damage done to the ship?
I don't recall. I don't think so, because we went on in the ship a couple of days later, so it couldn't have been very much.
What happened to you at Gibraltar?
Nothing in particular. I mean, we just went ashore to exercise, having been, I think we'd probably, in the ship, although we didn't know it, we'd almost been out as far as America and back again, right out into the Atlantic. It wasn't a direct route across the Bay of Biscay. But no, it was fine.
So what happened next?
Oh, then we sailed on and we disembarked at a port called Bougie on the North African coast. And we then, we were all had our own, apart from the troop carrying transport of the Royal Army Service Corps, we were all on wheels, being a lorried infantry battalion, and we moved up and eventually went into the line on Christmas Eve near, and I've gone and forgotten the name of the village, but near Medjez El Bab on Christmas Eve 1942. I recall it was a very, very bright moonlight night, moonlit night, so it was a full moon, and very clear and still. That was our first introduction to proper war.
What did the line consist of in those in that area?
I don't honestly know. Well, as a junior officer, one's perspective, as I've already said, is very much limited. One's horizons are limited. You knew where the battalion was, but you knew very little about anything else.
What did the landscape look like?
You know, I'd never thought of that, but as far as I remember, it was low, rolling hills covered with sort of scrubby bushes, as best I remember. Of course, it was winter. It was, it was really quite cold, and eventually it got very wet indeed. We were soaked to the skin for most of the time. And lived in the open, of course. There was nothing There was there were very few buildings, and what were ridden with fleas. And they weren't really buildings, they were Arab huts more than anything else, when we were sitting out on the side of the hill. And an interesting fact was that most of the battalion was very fit when we were out there, but directly with that particular campaign was over and we went into more or less permanent tents and things in Tunis, everybody went down with a cold, which was funny. We'd survived the horrible winter, but directly one got in sight under cover, the bugs came rattling out.
So when you went into the line, first of all, at Medjez El Bab, or that area...
Bourada was the name of the village, I've now remembered.
What was your first experience of action against the enemy?
Luckily, as I've explained already, my little two-pounder anti-tank guns would have been singularly ineffective. I luckily didn't go into action with them. I mean, one sat in one sit trench and was shelled or mortared, and that was about all the action one saw.
How accurate was the shelling and mortaring?
Oh, pretty accurate. It was all around you, and you just hope that it didn't meet you. And we were dive-bombed by the Junkers, whatever it was, dive bomber. I mean, various people were wounded, some were killed. But I was just jolly lucky.
What was the morale of the unit here?
Oh, I don't think one questioned that sort of thing. It was brilliant. I think one was probably very young in those days. I, as I say, 19 or 20. And I think was a very young 20 looking back on it. I think nowadays a 20-year-old would have been much more perceptive. And remember, I hadn't been to university, so I didn't, get a wider perspective. One went almost straight from being a schoolboy into the army.
How were the junior officers treated by the senior officers in the battalion?
Oh, very well, because I mean this was a family regiment, and there was no sort of bullying or anything like that. Some of them one had known all one's life.
Can you take me through your experiences from first arriving at Bourada to going through the campaign, please?
I think there were very little one. I wasn't in a rifle platoon at that time, and so one was sighted one's guns in accordance with the principles that one had been taught at a course I did in an anti-tank gunnery at up the road here near Lark Hill. At Netherhaven, and you sat and hoped for the best as things went on, until the end of the campaign. The rifle platoons, of course, had a terrific time on Longstop Hill and a hill called Tangusha, which I think both are on there, were battle honours of the regiment.
Where did you end up?
We ended up just outside Tunis, when the German army surrendered.
Did you see anything of the German POWs?
Just long columns going back, yes, as we went in. Them going back to the rear areas and we going forward. But apart from that, no.
What opinion by then had you formed of the enemy?
Again, 50 years later, it's difficult to find out one's condition by all the history one has read since then, and it's difficult to know, put oneself back. I think one accepted it as being perfectly normal. Rather thankful that particular episode was over.
What happened then at Tunis?
We rested, re-equipped, trained, got ready for the invasion of Sicily. Which later on, I forget, I think it was later that summer, I can't really remember, that we went in. And
did you take part in the Sicily landings yourself?
Yes, we weren't in the assault landing, we were follow-up troops. There again, I was still commanding the anti-tank platoon, which didn't see action much, because the country, we went up the central bit of Sicily, along the eastern slopes of Mount Etna. And that campaign was over quite reasonably quickly. I can't really remember. I could look it up, but it's imagination. It's about six weeks, a couple of months, something like that, before we reached the other side. The Germans evacuated across the Straits of Messina into Italy properly.
Did you have to use your weapons against German tanks?
Against German tanks, no, never. I only once in Sicily used to fire the anti-tank guns in anger, and that was I was firing at an assault crossing of a river. We were on the high ground on our side, and our own troops were out in the middle, rather pinned down. And I got the section, two guns, into action, firing solid shot over their heads against snipers' positions in buildings the other side, which did, in fact, silence them. But one of my friends, who, in fact, was lying wounded on the one of the assault troops, he was shot in the knee, said quite the most frightening experience was having my solid shot fired over, you know, a couple of feet over his head, while he was lying there in the sun, wounded.
Who was this comrade?
He was a chap called Pat Brady, who is still alive and lives in Suffolk somewhere, Norfolk somewhere.
Do you know the name of this river crossing?
I can't remember now.
Any other memories of Sicily?
No, I don't think so at all. It's the war was fiercer somehow, as one went on, compared with North Africa. Of course, it was a good deal more defensive country than the Germans were defending. We were attacking. It was mountainous. But no, not particularly.
Did you have any contact with the Sicily population?
Other than driving through villages and sort of buying eggs off them, no. Don't think so.
What happened next?
I think we went into a camp by the sea. I remember I went into hospital for a short time with malaria, and then we did an assault landing in up on the east coast of Italy on the Adriatic, and so just south of Bari. And for the life of me, I can't remember the name, but I could look it up in a second.
Don't worry, that will be on in the regimental record anyway. And was it in Italy that you changed from your regiment?
This was a bit later on. I changed. We were up by that time. We'd taken part in the Battle of the Sangro Crossing, and I'd gone back and met a friend who was in the 2nd Special Air Service Regiment. He was in Enniskillen. And I thought it would be rather fun to join, so I did. And I was accepted.
How did you go about applying to join?
In those days, it was, if you happened to know somebody, you just joined. There was no tests or whatever. And this was merely a small detachment of number 2 squadron in the Special Forces base near Bari. And in about a fortnight, 3 weeks, as best I remember, we went back to England, strangely enough, on the Tegelberg again, the same ship that I'd come out on, for doing parachute training and things like that. But I remember going across Italy with a friend, a chap, he's died now, a chap called Scott, who I met again years later after the war. In fact, when I left the army finally, I worked for the Diocese of Winchester, and this chap, who he and I had amused ourselves sitting in the train shooting at the insulators of the telegraph poles with our pistols. Not that we ever succeeded in hitting one, but but he was rather a respected incumbent of a parish in South Hampshire, a clergyman, in fact. And I met him years later, and then we embarked at Naples and sailed home.